right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. Okay, you guys, introducing Jeff Abramson. He is Senior Fellow for Conventional Arms Control and Transfers at the Arms Control Association. That's armscontrol.org. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Really happy to have you here. And to be clear, we're not talking about banning small arms in, you know, Second Amendment stuff. We're talking about international military arms transfers here. And in fact, unlike usual, we're not basing this interview off a specific article that you've written so much as a question that came up in the Reddit room, which was, hey, Scott, could you get a good expert on to explain really the nuts and bolts so I can imagine how it works about how these massive military arms transfers are arranged? There's clearly nothing free market about it. It's all state licenses and different agencies and politics and congressional leaders involved and who knows what kind of lobbying and favoritism and all kinds of mechanics. So, hey, Scott, find somebody who can really teach us the mechanics. And so I asked Bill Hartung, because he's about the best on this stuff, and he says you should talk to Jeff Abramson. So that's why I'm talking to you. What if, say, I was a Raytheon salesman and I was trying to help commit genocide in Yemen for the bucks? How would I go about doing that?
That's an interesting way to frame it, but yeah, thanks for bringing me on. The U.S. does have a really complicated system on how it sells weapons, and it's true that there are all sorts of actors, including the government, including companies, and I'm happy to sort of piece that through. There's lots of bits to it, so I'm not quite sure where to start. But this administration in particular definitely is involved. They want to be and have talked about selling arms as a core part of their arms policy for the economy. Other presidents have also talked about the economic benefits, but nowhere in the same way that Trump has. So you will see him talking about how great it is to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. And he meets with the prince, he shakes hands and holds up big posters of weapons we're selling. So the United States government is definitely involved. That's one piece. But let me ask you how you want to go through, and I can talk about the different players in whatever order makes the most sense.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I was just kind of picking the Raytheon point of view at random, but it could be, you know, if I was a Saudi prince wanting to commit genocide, or if I was a senator trying to make a couple of thousand bucks, and so I was committing genocide, or whichever, you know, to you is the most interesting way of approaching it, I guess, is fine with me. You have an open floor, I guess, you know, or I don't, yeah, you know what? What if I was a senator and I had a lobbyist's lawyer pay me $2,000. So now I'm pro-genocide. As Ben Freeman has shown, that's exactly how it works. And so now I want to make sure that Raytheon can sell as many weapons as possible to the Saudis and the UAE to use against the civilian population of Yemen. What all is required? What do I need to do to make sure that this works so I can have my $2,000?
Yeah, you know, hopefully you're not committing to genocide for $2,000. But if you explicitly say you want to commit genocide, there are, I hope, enough safeguards in place that we would stop you. But certainly weapons have ended up doing that, so it is a big concern. At the large level, the United States government has to approve arms sales. Congress has a role in this. So if you're a senator, especially if you're a senator on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is the committee in charge of arms sales, you can help grease the wheels. You can have the conversations with the State Department and the government and other governments to try to make the pieces work and come together. It's not that hard to do, I suppose, but it's also a lot of procedure and it takes a lot of time. But those senators on that committee and then on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, by law are supposed to be consulted in the arms trade. And some of them will actively promote the arms trade. So having a congressional outreach strategy is a good one. You also need to have insights within the Defense Department and the State Department. They are the ones that end up helping with negotiations, or at least approving negotiations, depending on how you do it. And that's when you start getting into the really confusing mix of different programs and ways the United States sells weapons. Sometimes the United States government actually makes a deal with another country. They say, I will sell you these weapons, and that's a foreign military sale. That's kind of what we do with Saudi Arabia and a lot of countries. They come to the United States government itself and say, we want to do this. Sometimes the deals are made in more of a commercial transaction, which we call direct commercial sales, where the companies and the foreign government might work out the deal, and then they'll bring it to the United States government for approval. But generally, the United States government is involved in all those along the way, too. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of players, but if you know who the right players are that are making the decisions, you can make things go.
Mm-hmm. And then, so essentially, even though these are sort of pseudo private companies, that these are all licensed deals. Essentially, the government is involved. The State Department, especially, is involved in deciding what all is allowed to go, or what? I guess DOD, too.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, it's technically it's an interagency process, which might involve the Defense Department. The Defense Department is heavily involved, especially on these foreign military sales, because they will say, hey, you want to buy this, but we think maybe you should have this equipment better, would be better suited for your needs. Sometimes countries care what the Defense Department thinks you might actually need, and sometimes they just want to get prizy equipment. But officially, the State Department notifies the Congress. Now, obviously, by the time the State Department does that, it's been bought off by the, it's been agreed to by the administration. So that'll involve the Commerce Department off as well. And then the Congress can block. It very rarely blocks an arms sale. So that's why you don't often see a lot of controversy. But I'm happy to talk about those moments where there are controversy, because the process is getting a bit murkier, and I'm very concerned about it. Mm-hmm. But yes, these are all, these major arms sales are approved by the U.S. government, and they have to not be blocked by the Congress before actually those deals can be agreed. So the Department of Commerce, the Department of State will present to Congress, this is what we want to do. Generally, Congress will have 30 days to block it. They generally don't. And then you can see an agreement made, but often it's then years later before those weapons go out the door. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, so I'm not sure the specifics. I guess I really should read the law. I hear references to it all the time, the Leahy Law, but I know there are others that are a lot like it that say that if a country is involved in committing human rights abuses, I don't know if this is just domestically or in international conflict, that the Americans are supposedly forbidden from by the law from dealing with them, either giving them military troops to use, you know, deploying special forces in support of them or anything like that, or selling them weapons or anything else. But I don't know the specifics of that. How's that work?
Yeah, let me give you a big picture piece of that. It's certainly true. The Foreign Assistance Act in 1961 is really where this started. And then the Arms Export Control Act in the 70s put a lot of this in place, with the provisions that if we're selling weapons, they should be used for legitimate self-defense purposes. They shouldn't be used for human rights abuses. And in theory, if we actually applied our laws to our arms sales, a lot of them wouldn't move forward. The American Bar Association has looked at a lot of deals, especially those to Saudi Arabia, given the conflict in Yemen, and would say these just don't seem to pass muster. But Congress has kind of punted in a lot of cases, and those deals, even though our laws are good, are going through. The Leahy Law, the one you mentioned there, is probably the best known one. It's not as involved as people think. The Leahy Law, as it's currently being implemented, generally has to do with training of forces. So forces that have been known to commit abuses are not supposed to get training. The Leahy Law could be applied more broadly, but generally hasn't been. But that is one of the strongest laws we have, and has made a difference. But when we're talking about these big sales, now, the Leahy Law may not always be taken into account, but the larger laws that do exist are. But you will see, and this is probably a controversy I know you've talked with others about in the past. Last year, the president said, hey, I need to get weapons to the Saudis and the Emiratis, and it's an emergency to get them there. Mm-hmm. And he asked for a waiver. He used this sort of emergency provision, which really wasn't meant to be used the way he did. And that's what's been in the news lately with the Linick firing, who was investigating the sale last year, of whether this emergency was for real. So there are ways that the president gets around it. And we saw in our Congress the first time, well, not the first time, but an important effort to block. And the president actually had to veto Congress's effort to say, no, you can't do this. And that, you know, had some Republicans on it as well. Mm-hmm. So this issue is getting a ton of attention, and it's confusing also to people in Congress, not just the American public.
Right. And now, so about that recent story, that's, you know, a good hook for, you know, the overall picture here, where Congress had said, we want to block some arms sales. They won't defund the whole thing or pass the correct kind of War Powers Resolution that would be veto-proof, not by numbers, but just by form. But they do things like say, okay, no, but we want to, you know, block the next round of bomb shipments at least. And then Pompeo says, the Secretary of State says, well, we're going to check the box that says it's an emergency so we can do it anyway. And then he was under investigation by the inspector general. And it seemed like there was a limited hangout there where they talked about walking the dog and baking the cookies and whatever, this kind of thing. When what was really going on was he was possibly going to be in trouble for, as well, I don't want to misquote you, but you just put it, something about misapplying the rules there in order to invoke that emergency and send the weapons anyway. Can you be more specific there about, I mean, do you agree with that, that he, you know, twisted the letter of the law to get away with what he did there?
It certainly seems possible. You know, I've tried to pay a little bit of attention to Linick testified, and he was really careful. Although if you look at it, it does seem that pressure was applied on him early on not to investigate this. It wasn't directly by Pompeo, but looks like by others. But certainly, the scandal that has arisen about this has shown sort of the murky side of the arms trade. And whether or not Pompeo did it, I can't tell. It certainly is not impossible for high-ranking officials within the government to make things happen, even though they shouldn't. Yeah. And that's, I think, one of the questions.
Yeah, it seems like it's up to him to say what's an emergency or not, right? As long as the president agrees with him.
But I think the president is the one who's making the decision, and his secretaries are following his lead. I think they've all learned that if you don't do that pretty quickly, you're out of a job. I don't know if I blame Pompeo as much as I would say this is probably the president behind it.
Mm. Well, I mean, certainly Pompeo supports the policy, so, you know, same difference. But yeah, Donald Trump, of course, you know, it should never go without saying, even though it should go without saying, it should also be mentioned every time, that Donald Trump could stop this war right now with a spoken word. He wouldn't even have to pick up a pen. He could just tell the chief of staff to tell the Secretary of Defense to turn it off, and that's it, and it'd be over. Never mind the arms sales, but the overall war itself in Yemen as it's continuing now. And so there's a lot of responsibility there. And that ain't Mike Pompeo is not in charge of the Pentagon. It's Donald Trump that is.
I'm not going to disagree with you. I think the United States could certainly be doing a lot more to stop this war instead of fueling it, which is what I see them doing right now.
Hold on just one second. Be right back. So you're constantly buying things from Amazon.com. Well, that makes sense. They bring it right to your house. So what you do, though, is click through from the link in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. Won't cost you a thing. Nice little way to help support the show. Again, that's right there in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, check it out. The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published three great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, the Scott Horton Show interviews 2004 through 2019, interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the Good Doctor over the years on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. You need stickers for your band or your business? Well, Rick and the guys over at thebumpersticker.com have got you covered. Great work, great prices, sticky things with things printed on them. Whatever you need, thebumpersticker.com will get it done right for you. Thebumpersticker.com. So now, it must have been funny to be sitting over at the Arms Control Association and see the Democrats impeach a Republican president for holding up an arms deal that they wanted weapons to go to the Nazi-infested national security forces of the government of Ukraine. So I wonder where you came down on that one.
Well, I don't want to comment too much on the Ukrainian forces the way you have. What was really interesting is that many of the vetoes and many of the attention that have happened in this Trump administration had to deal with war and arms sales. We have attention on this issue like you've never seen. It was certainly amazing that there have been changes of opinion on whether it made sense to arm the Ukrainians. But once that sort of general opinion was out there, the way that Trump misused his authority leading to an impeachment was just an amazing show of how he is acting in ways that are not in the norm for what we expect a president to do. He is using power that is not supposed to be used in that way to try and change behavior. And it's really, I think, unacceptable. So I think it was good that that impeachment process went through. I think it was good we have attention on it. I think most of the attention wasn't really on the weapons so much as on the process, but I think it would be better if we were also paying much more attention to the weapons themselves.
Yeah, it seems like they should have impeached him for sending weapons to Ukraine.
I think there's... Yeah, I don't want to get too much into all the possible reasons for impeachment. I think there's lots of them.
Yeah, like arming Ukraine. But anyway, and the Yemenis, whatever. But of course, we understand how it works. It's not the secret bombing of Cambodia. It's the burglary at the headquarters of the opposite political party that gets you in trouble. You know, we know how it goes. But same thing here. Okay, so now, what about like Taiwan? And there's one where it's so politicized and they can afford it, I guess, that, you know, we send them all kinds of F-16s and I have no idea what all America has armed them with. I know, you know, F-16 fighter bombers are no joke. As far as naval resources and defensive missiles or whatever, I have no idea. But that is also something that is almost completely decided at the National Security Council in consultation with the different arms companies. But I wonder, you know, how often does it seem like the arms manufacturers are really driving the car there and telling the NSC, okay, look, we've got these weapons we need to sell. What customers do you have for us?
Yeah, that's it's a great question. And some of that does occur, but I think it's also... You need to have, if you're a seller, let's say, you need to have a government, a president and a government in place that is amenable to your approach, which I think this president has. So it's a bit harder if you have someone who is in charge who is hesitant or reticent to provide arms. This president, President Trump, is not. I mean, he is certainly pivoting towards providing more weapons into the region. You know, he has, in his Defense Department, has sort of redefined our security concerns as having a great deal to do with China. And so the arming of Taiwan is certainly consistent with the Trumpian approach to the world. Past presidents have done it as well. I think they've been much more careful about doing so. But I think you can look to arms to Taiwan and other activities that are happening around Asia to see that this president certainly has a desire to see a military option available, or at least a buildup of capabilities in the region. And, you know, the relationship between the U.S. and China is one that also deals with trade. I mean, it's a big issue, but we have defined China as a threat in a way that wasn't defined previously in the last few years. And so does selling of those weapons to Taiwan is not a surprise. The Chinese pushed back immediately, which is also the dynamic. I mean, this has been going on for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in fact, on the question of China policy, does it seem like the shipbuilders really have a lot to do with lobbying for a more hawkish policy here? I mean, that's a lot of money for naval capacity.
Yeah, I'm just going to be careful because I don't follow the ship industry that closely, so I don't know exactly what they are doing. But in general, if you are a weapons provider and a builder, you are in the business of helping to convince the government that your services are needed. So yeah. I don't.
That is very polite of you. Yes.
The best way to put it, but uh-huh. I don't follow quite shipbuilding industry. I try to be careful. I think a lot of the people in the defense industry get painted as evil incarnate. And a lot of what I think happens is not good and it should be stopped. But generally those people have a different point of view and they think that what they're selling is an important commodity towards safety. And we can just disagree about how that works. But I think we got to be careful because if we demonize, which we are doing more and more on all sides, we stop being able to communicate and move forward.
Sure. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And of course, most evil, especially in government bureaucracy and related industries, is perfectly banal, right? It's not nefarious, secret plotting in the dark as much as you just said, perfectly rationalized professional behavior. Hey, Senator, we've got some great new hydrogen bombs to sell you here. And then, of course, it's for defense. Whatever. Still making money selling H-bombs. That's just how it goes. In fact, I know a guy who used to make H-bombs during the Cold War days. He was the former chief scientist of the Army and worked at the laboratories and stuff. And I asked him, man, how could you make H-bombs? And he wasn't an H-bomb salesman. He actually made them. And he says, well, I mean, we believe we were keeping the Soviets out of the Fall de Gap. We were protecting Western Europe from being conquered by the Reds. Now, maybe it's different. But then, perfectly easy to rationalize. No question about it. Even though you're talking about building city killers, things that go off in the tens of megatons. That somehow this
right.
is...
I mean, certainly...
Go ahead.
Someone from the Arms Control Association, such as I am, is anti-H-bombs, right? And we're not building to sell these now at this time. I certainly hope, although we have some concerns about where Trump's going with nuclear testing as well.
Yeah.
But this is the common defense or the common statement that the defense industry will say is that anything we sell has been approved by the United States government.
Right.
So the onus then becomes on changing the mind or the practice of the government. It's easy to paint and see a lot of the defense industry as pushing for this, which I believe they do. But the buck needs to stop at the government policy level and policies that are making this world less safe are really the problem here.
Right. And that's really kind of the fun of it, right? Is the paradox of the diffusion of responsibility all the way around too, where the senators are saying, well, I don't know, all the experts are telling me that this is what we have to do. And it just goes around in a circle and all of that. But I was just, essentially trying to agree with you that these are not demons at all. These are human men doing jobs is what they are. And they will even build H-bombs if that's their job. And so, yeah, you're right. It's up to people like you and the broader civil society to say that we actually do not have a demand for H-bombs and we don't want them. And you can sick your very best salesman on us and it's not going to do you any good. But that takes a real consensus against the status quo, which we just don't have.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I want to sort of pick up a little bit on what you said in there for your audience might be interesting as well, in that, I professionally keep track of the arms trade, right? I'm not the H-bomb. There's not a trade in nuclear weapons, but there's a trade in conventional weapons. And we as the public, I'm part of the public. I don't have security clearance. I'm losing transparency in what we do. It's absolutely true that the public needs to have the capability to pay attention to this. And actually, public opinion polling shows that the majority of Americans across parties don't believe arms sales make the United States safer. Even a larger majority, I think nuclear weapons are crazy. So, it takes a while sometimes to change your politicians. But the way the policies are developing over time right now is we're losing transparency in terms of what weapons we're selling. We are trying to convince the Congress to maybe flip the script on how we do this instead of Congress having to block arms sales, them to actually have to approve arms sales, because there's a lot more transparency in what Congress does sometimes than what's happening in the administration. The reporting on what we are selling is getting worse. You can jump into that if that's helpful, but this issue area is one where the public does need to pay attention. I think that they get it. I think they get when they see images of people, children killed in Yemen with American bombs, that they don't want to see that kind of behavior happen. They don't want our weapons going out the door that way, or they don't want our weapons being used against us, which also happens when we're not careful. So I think there's a lot there and a lot of awareness that could grow, and there's already some that exists, and we just need to make it a little stronger.
And I see you have this recent article about landmine policy and some lawmakers getting good on it and trying to force the issue with the Secretary of Defense. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, certainly. So this is another crazy step by this Trump administration to reverse the policy of the past administration, which was at least moving us closer to never using landmines again. The Trump administration says, well, actually, we might need to use these. Let's open up to use them around the world. And let's, instead of making the president in charge of the decision, let's let the combatant commanders do it. And he's really sort of couching this as a great power competition. And the idea that somehow we need to use these weapons, which essentially kill civilians, you know, put them down on the ground or you toss them down through artillery, and they can't tell a soldier from a civilian. And the people getting killed are kids a lot of the time. The United States wanting to use these weapons just is insane. And that's what the Trump administration is kind of moving the wrong direction on. For years, there's been a bipartisan consensus that there needs to be a lot more care around using these weapons. So there's a lot of questions that have just gone in. We haven't gotten answers from the Defense Department on this. But 162 countries around the world have agreed never to use these, including all of our NATO allies. So the fact the United States wants to go the wrong way on this is just really alarming. And another sign of this president not wanting to be a part of the global consensus, but wanting to go his own way.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I think, too, the broader American culture has got to have a reckoning with landmines. And, you know, for that matter, the cluster bomb units, the little bombies, as they call them, that are left everywhere that kill innocent civilians. We still have hundreds. I think it's, what, 600-something Cambodians a year continue to die from the cluster bomb units after 50 years since Nixon's secret war there. It's just incredible.
Yeah, the legacy in Laos and the countries around there of continued deaths after the 60s and the 70s when these were deployed is atrocious. We're seeing some improvements. I mean, it's easy to be pessimistic, like the problem will never be solved. I do think it can be over time. But that legacy, I think a lot of Americans do understand that wow, I can't believe 50 years later, the weapons we use are still killing kids. It is alarming. And I think most Americans, if they think about it, wouldn't want our country using these weapons. And for the most part, we don't, but we refuse to say we won't. And we refuse to sort of be with the global consensus that says against them.
You know, one of the coolest things I've seen in recent years was a project that was, you know, relatively inexpensive to have drones that have metal detectors on them go flying around out in the jungle searching for cluster bomb units and landmines. And then they drop tiny little shape charges on top and fly away and then detonate them. And they're just going around and they're, you know, extremely cost and time efficient. It's the kind of thing where if you dumped real money into a project like that, you could actually solve the problem in a place or you know, make major headway in a place like Laos or Cambodia or Afghanistan or Iraq. I don't know how many landmines are in Iraq, but certainly in Afghanistan, there's cluster bomb units laying around.
You have an omnivorous reading list, I think. That's not many people know about these programs. Yeah, there's tons of different ways of trying to figure it out. One thing that's really difficult about mine clearance and cluster mission clearance is you got to get it right. So there is a lot of promise in some of these drone systems, but you got to really know that it worked. So the people who do this stuff are pretty careful. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, if you were living next to a minefield, you would never go over there until you were sure it was clear. So you don't want to make even one mistake. But there's promising stuff happening in drone technology. There's all sorts of ways to look at this. And, you know, you probably know, and it's really kind of amazing. The United States is by far the world's largest funder of these types of efforts of clearance of old weapons that are in the ground or just in stockpiles, by far the biggest funder. And then to suddenly come around and say, but we want to make it easier to use these weapons that cause these problems is really nonsensical.
Actually makes perfect sense in a very horrible and cynical way as a continuing racket. But yeah, on the face of it, it is completely crazy. Let me ask you this. I'm sure the answer must be yes. You're good on all these nuke treaties with Russia that are expiring right now. Can I ask you about them?
They're not my specialty, but I'll see what I can do. Sure.
And it seems like it matters a lot that Bush Jr. pulled us out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, and now Trump is letting three expire: the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the Open Skies Treaty, and START II, correct?
New START.
You know,
we're hoping something can happen on New START before the end of his term. But yeah, he's backing away from a whole range of sensible arms control agreements, which, you know, threaten new arms races, which makes no sense. So yes, you hit the nail on it right there, that all these agreements that give us transparency into what's happening, help limit what other countries do, he wants to walk away from for no really good reason. They can all be worked out. And there's more. I mean, we're hearing rumors about wanting to do changes on something called the missile technology control regime to make it easier to sell armed drones, which could lead to proliferation of those weapons around the world as well. The idea of a U.S. go it alone approach really starts to fall apart when you realize other people need to agree to a process moving forward.
Yeah. Now
the new start one is, you know, just super crazy.
Yeah, talk about that. I mean, what's in the New START Treaty? I mean, they really watered it down to get it passed back in the Obama years, I know, or at least they had to make major compromises on building up certain aspects of the industry as a trade-off to get it through. But what does it say, and what's it about to not say anymore?
Yeah, I'm going to be a bit careful here on this because my colleagues are much more expert on this, but there were some compromises in any negotiation, but essentially the New START treaty puts limits on U.S. and Russian weapons, nuclear weapon systems, and called for a reduction in terms of the numbers that were pre-existing. And pretty much we're reducing. When the treaty expires, there'll no longer be an inspection regime. There'll no longer be agreements to limitations on how many nuclear weapons you could have, which is nuts. I mean, that's sort of the basic core of it. And it doesn't take much to extend it. They just have to say, we're going to extend it for another 5 years. But the Trump administration has not said that he's willing to do that, or he's trying to convince China to come on board as part of this process, which is not the right way to go about this. But that's the core of it, is it would remove the agreement on limits and the transparency that we have in looking at what countries, what the Russians have.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it, Jeff.
Hey, sure. Good luck, Scott. And thanks for bringing me on this conversation.
All right, you guys. That is Jeff Abramson. He is Senior Fellow for Conventional Arms Control and Transfers at the Arms Control Association. And that is armscontrol.org. The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.